Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Bold Beautiful Borderline podcast. My name is Lori, and today I am joined yet again by my dad, aka Dad Dean, for all the super feelers out there. And today we're going to be doing chapter 10 of Stop Walking on Eggshells for the BPD book club. This chapter is called Waiting for the Next Shoe to Drop, Your Borderline Child. So, Dad, initial thoughts on this chapter?
So it seemed to me in my note here that from when I read this, that it seems to assume that the borderline kid is completely non-functional, like
yes,
unable to do anything in any sort of functional fashion. And I just find that, again, I mean, like we talked about in chapter 9, it's all one-sided. It's just, it's a very, having experienced a borderline kid, and I guess one could say that maybe even been one myself to some extent, it's a little hard to deal with. So that was my initial, I read the whole thing and then I wrote that.
Yeah, that's fair. I have a note at the very beginning saying LOL, so dramatic. And the reason for that is it starts with like a story of parent of like a set of parents. And it talks about how the kid was diagnosed with BPD at 14. She had sex with several men at a party and then tried to hire gang members to kill her parents. And it's like,
I do have a personal story on that issue, if you want.
Did you try and hire gang members to kill your parents?
No, you told friends that you wanted to have your dad killed.
Oh, I did say that.
And then, I got called from the RCMP.
I know you did. No, I remember that drastically. But...
I didn't actually take it seriously myself, but I was worried about friends hiring killers.
Yeah.
That's a movie script.
So yes, for sure. I definitely threatened to kill you. I definitely threatened to kill others 100%. But yes, the RCMP did get involved that one time, but like it's the hiring gang members to kill your parent. Like she's 14. I don't know. It just seems like overly dramatic for no reason.
Well, and maybe this is a stereotype. I just kind of assume that the average teenager doesn't know actual gang members.
And especially like to hire them, like
with whose money?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just, it could have, like, you could have said like, she, you know, she threatened to kill her parents. Totally. But it just seems like extra dramatic for the sake of the drama. Anyways, so...
But even at that, let's go back to the threatening to kill your parents thing.
Yeah.
I never actually felt threatened by you. Mm. This was a call out of the blue one day from the RCMP.
Whoops.
Saying...
RCMP is Royal Canadian Mounted Police, by the way, is our police force.
Sorry. So, if I remember correctly, it was a situation where you had either... put something on Facebook.
I did, yeah.
And,
good old days of Facebook.
And some like school counselor had read it, which of course then they're required to report it. And
yeah,
then the cops called me to say, this is what your daughter did. And I wasn't actually the least bit worried about it. I wasn't worried about you doing it.
Yeah.
I didn't know your friends well enough to know whether they would have done it, because that was the only worry I had.
Oh, and, yeah, definitely not. My friends were the ones who reported it to the school.
Oh, were they? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So,
yeah.
And I don't know. I told the RCMP guy all of what I just told you. And I said, I think they said, well, what would you like me to do? And I said, well, what I'd like you to do is go over to her house and scare the shit out of her. That's what I'd like you to do. And I actually don't know what happened after that.
I don't think they did that.
Yeah.
Somebody called me, either MCFD or Ministry of Children and Family Development or RCMP called me and talked to me on the phone.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
but
there you go.
But I don't remember what actually happened. But anyways, I wasn't going to kill you. But definitely did not want to hire gang members to kill you. That's hella dramatic.
Yeah.
So then, yeah. So it says, like, Amy tells us if we had not hospitalized her 3 days later, we would have been dead. Okay. Well, the whole vibe I get from this chapter is, like, kind of a savior mentality of parents. Parents play a key role, obviously, in care and BPD and all this stuff, but like it kind of gives the vibe of like, well, without the parents, this person would have never recovered because the parents are the ones who saved her. And I don't think that's healthy for any side of this.
Well, and I don't think it's true. I mean, if we go back to the first podcast I did with you, whatever year that was, last year, whatever it was, most parents, I think, are more in denial than helpful. I don't think mm-hmm. that most parents are able initially to see borderline and help deal with it. They need help figuring it out, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that these parents are saving the world from their child, I just don't think that's a very, realistic way of the way parenting actually works with a child with mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I mean, they talk later on in the chapter about boundary setting. And I think that is really important. Like, you know, when my other parent called the police on me and they came and just like took me out, well, fair. That was like part of hitting rock bottom that was healthy, but that individual wasn't the like savior of the situation. They just finally put their foot down and then it helped me realize that I needed to change. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And this is implying something else to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think the examples in this chapter are so bad
that
it's hard to kind of take a lot of reality out of it. Cause you know, you well, back to the first part, you know, you saying, you know, somebody should kill my dad or whatever the wording was, that's hyperbole. I mean, that's most kids at some point want to kill their parents.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. Right. And very, very few of them actually do it.
Foreshadowing to the end of this podcast. No, I'm just kidding.
We are in the same room.
So yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I should be aware.
We're recording together today. So watch out.
The cats are hungry.
Yeah, exactly. it's definitely hyperbole. And like some of these examples I'm sure have happened to people, but the issue is like, why are you only picking those examples in this book?
Yeah.
Right. Like that's part of this podcast is we try and share like a wide range of stories because some people's stories look completely different. And I'm sure we've had situations that are this dramatic that have come up, but like the vast majority aren't. And we try and highlight those too. Anyways. So it talks just about like how they had challenges with parenting her.
Okay. I want to talk for a second, go back up to misdiagnosis.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Go for it.
So I want you to just talk a second about that. Cause it says here that in the hospital, psychiatrists diagnosed Amy with bipolar disorder. A year later, they changed the diagnosis to BPD. I remember you saying on several occasions that bipolar is a lot of times the misdiagnosis for BPD.
100%.
Do you want to comment on that or do you want to just move forward?
No, I mean, it's often misdiagnosed. We have many, many, many listeners that have been misdiagnosed as bipolar and we've talked about it a lot on the podcast before. I don't think there's anything like majorly.
Yeah. Okay. I just highlighted it just because I know you've talked about it. So,
yeah. All right,
so back down here to life.
So life today. So today's Sharon and Amy, Sharon's the mom, and Amy have a close relationship. When we asked Sharon about how she put aside the past, she said, that's why they call it unconditional love. The pain of mental illness is worse than any pain we've ever felt. We lived with it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's no way to explain the hell that Kim was growing up in. Kim is the other kid. This is terribly written. But it was hard for my family to watch Amy, but our determination to get through this with all the love and support we can muster is what made it possible for Amy to find her little niche of happiness in this world. So a couple things about this. One, like, I don't know if I believe in unconditional love as a general concept. So there's that. But also they talk about like, this is that savior mentality again, like, but with our determination to get through this and all the love and support, we made it possible for Amy to find blah, 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 blah. But never did they talk about how they actually did that. There's no like tangible examples of like, we did X, Y, Z. It was just like, we're great people because we saved her with unconditional love, which is not helpful as an example in a book.
Yeah. And I mean, back to what unconditional love is, it depends on what you mean by conditions, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Because there is a point at which with any kid, you have to just not let them do stuff.
Yeah. Which they do talk about.
You have to make rules. You have to, you know, you have to allow freedom as well as constraint, mm-hmm. because that's, I think, how kids function best. And I think that that's in a lot of ways, especially true with a kid with borderline. They have to, and later on this comes up with about, you know, when we would go into situations where you guys had never been, I always tried to explain as best I could what to expect when you got there. Mm. Because otherwise you'd walk in and it would be a trigger, basically.
Yeah,
you had no idea what to expect.
Yeah.
I think that would be a helpful thing to put in here. But they don't talk about how to do that, right?
Yeah.
At all, really. So like you say, they just kind of said this kind of extreme, you know, life was hell 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then they don't ever talk about how they got to the point where now it's happiness and mm-hmm. all sweetness and light. It seems a little weird to me, but.
Yeah, exactly. So the next bit is about helping other parents of children with BPD. And I think this acronym is fucking hysterical. The acronym for a parent support group is called Needing Understanding, Tenderness, and Support, which equals NUTS. So it keeps talking about how NUTS parents, children of NUTS parents, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, that's incredible. I love it. And it's probably true.
I was going to ask you when I read this, because they mentioned a whole bunch of different organizations. This is the one that they come back to a lot. Have you looked into any of the other ones at all?
No. Like, there's more modern, like, I don't know if this even exists anymore. And to be honest, if it's cited in this book, I don't really know if I want to know if it exists anymore, because it's probably not very healthy. But there are other services that are for parents with people with BPD that are way more helpful. So, or like are very helpful and modern. So Sash Bear Foundation, which we've talked about a lot, they have a, I can't remember the name of it. Family Connections Program, which is like basically teaching parents DBT skills and peer support. And I believe it's free. And then Emotions BC also has parent support groups for people who live with people in their lives. It's not necessarily parents, actually. It can be parents or like loved ones or siblings or whatever who have BPD or similar issues. So yeah, I don't know about NUTS, but Emotions BC and Sash Bear, at least in Canada, are really good options for that. This book is also clearly very outdated, because later on it says that a psychiatrist visit costs approximately $50. So I wouldn't take these resources as necessarily up to date. If they didn't even bother changing like that to add a 2 behind it.
When was this version published? Do you know? Do you remember? I know you said this is the second version. They've got a reference to 2004 in this.
I think it was 2004. Let me check.
Oh, the DSM. That's what they're
talking about. It says copyright 2010.
So it's 13 years out of date, at least.
At least.
Yeah.
Even 13 years ago, I feel like a psychiatrist visit would have been more than $50, though. But I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
But also first edition, I think, was maybe 2004. And so they may have not just like, they probably just did like a really shitty, like second edition and they didn't actually change a lot.
You had mentioned that last time, actually, you think they just added a couple of positive words here and there.
Yeah. I still think that that's what happened. So then it goes into a section about whether or not children can actually have borderline. This is an interesting section. I didn't fact check this section because I was too lazy. But this is probably the most helpful section in this chapter. So it talks about how, as we've talked about in the past, like personality disorders are usually only diagnosed after 18, but it talks about how there's a bit of a movement to be able to diagnose earlier. They talk about both sides of the coin there. So like people think that you shouldn't diagnose before 18 because personality disorders are like persistent and unlikely to change. And therefore it's like inherent to your personality as opposed to like children whose personalities are continuously changing. I don't know if I agree with that because I feel like people's personalities are kind of always changing, but, and 18 is kind of an arbitrary cutoff for that. I feel like that seems,
it's definitely an arbitrary cutoff.
Yeah. I was just saying my niece was here like on the weekend and she was like, when I turn 18, I'm an adult. And I was like, that's cute. Cause all my friends are like 32 and live in their parents' basements. So like, I don't know. I was like, I don't know if like 18 is the definition anymore of like what a adult is, you know what I mean?
They really should keep children away from you if you're going to corrupt their thinking like that.
Oh, yeah. It's when we first hung out with her, like this was like years ago, she was like 3 maybe or 4. When can kids talk? 4?
Oh, like,
badly talk.
2 or 3.
Okay, like 3. Anyways, yes. And she was like, I kept having to have naps because like, it's exhausting to be around children. And she said to Aaron, she's like, Uncle Aaron, why does Auntie Lori always need to sleep? And I was just like, because I have depression. And I was like, God, these like, I mean, anyways, I didn't have the heart to be like, because you're exhausting as fuck. So I figured depression was.
Yeah, that's good. She probably didn't need that.
No. Anyways, it was kind of funny. Yeah. So they talk about how children's personalities are still developing and therefore people don't want to diagnose. I mean, there's also arguments that they don't talk about this in this book, which is kind of funny, around like stigma and adding labels to people at that age that will then affect their medical treatment for the rest of their lives. Of course, they don't talk about stigma because this book is stigmatizing.
They do mention it here.
Do they?
Yeah, because patients with disorders are often labeled and stigmatized by the medical system. So
just an asshole then.
That's their token. That's their token reference. I don't think they don't really talk about it except in that one
little
6-word sentence. Yeah. So that's it.
Well,
I remember.
And it does say that the DSM for text revision that was published in 2004 had new guidelines around diagnosing BPD in people younger than 18. And it states that children can be diagnosed as long as the borderline traits have persisted for at least 1 year and the behavior is not accounted for by either normal development stage, effects of substance use, transient conditions such as eating disorders or depression. I don't know if that would be the same in DSM-5. I don't think I've seen that written in DSM-5, but don't quote me because I haven't looked it up. Yeah, so basically it just talks about that. And then it says an inaccurate diagnosis can often deprive the child of appropriate therapy and medication, which is totally true. I think that, because you know how I was saying in the gray little bubbles, I think that's where they've just added things that are like not asshole remarks. I think that's one of them. It's in a gray bubble to be like, and this is why it's bad to misdiagnose. But anyways.
Yeah, I mean, they earlier on when they're talking about the being diagnosed with bipolar, instead they basically say the doctor put her on drugs and then they didn't work, and so they came up with a different diagnosis. I'm not sure that's the best way to do that, but if you're not gonna, if that being the most likely mistake is to say that it's a bipolar condition, I guess what else options do you have if that's where you're going to start?
Yeah, I mean, the difference between bipolar and borderline are quite different though. So it's just kind of funny because it's like people, like doctors just like don't know what they're doing. I think a lot of the time, I'm like, there's obviously situations where it's more complicated than that, but a lot of the time it's just like either unwillingness to diagnose borderline, so they diagnose bipolar, which isn't helpful, or like just not understanding how they should be diagnosing.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm right, the similarity is the extremeness of it. Right.
Yeah. Mood shifts.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem is, my understanding of bipolar is those mood shifts can last for months.
Yeah.
And borderline's like 20 minutes.
If that, it could be like minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think that's I think it's a very strange misdiagnosis. If you were to ask enough questions to know how long the incidences of extremism lasted, it seems weird to me that that's the response, but I guess they have a drug for that. So then maybe they're coming at it backward. Like maybe they're saying, well, we have a drug for that. Let's do that.
Totally. Or like there's a ton of physician education from pharmaceutical companies about bipolar drugs. And therefore that's more in their brain than it is about. That's just an assumption, having worked in the medical field for a while, but that can be part of it. There are different types of bipolar, so that can be a little bit more confusing. So like generally bipolar is like 2 weeks high, 2 weeks low approximately. So it's that longer period. It can be more than that.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I didn't know there were different.
Yeah, but then there's something called bipolar 2, which I believe is like rapid cycling bipolar, which is faster swings than that, which that's often misdiagnosed and sometimes co-occurring according to psychiatrists. So that one I can see being more confusing And we've had a lot of people explain to us that like that is something that they're diagnosed with as well as borderline. But there's also other pieces of borderline that you wouldn't necessarily see in bipolar, like all of the like fears of abandonment and I don't know about dissociation, but like those like very core concepts of borderline that are very different than they would be in bipolar.
So. Yeah, but if you're asking children those questions, like people between say 12 and 18, I'm not sure those questions would be asked. I'm not sure those questions would get answers that made a lot of sense. Like what would a 12-year-old know about abandonment? Like unless they were a situation where a parent literally abandoned them. Then maybe.
They would probably look at it as like extreme separation anxiety and not necessarily ask the kid, but ask the parent about like, does this kid's separation anxiety like mirror others at their age group compared to what they're experiencing? That would be my guess. Also, okay. Things like self-harm would be something that bipolar is not like known for, whereas borderline, it's like one of the main criteria. Dissociation would probably be another one where it's about like, you know, it's always hard to describe dissociation, but like they would ask questions like, do you ever feel like you're looking outside of yourself into your world without like being in your body kind of thing? Or like, do you ever get like so numb that you lose track of time? Like that kind of stuff you could probably ask a kid.
Are those borderline things?
That's some descriptions of dissociation, which is like being outside of yourself kind of. It's very hard to explain and everybody experiences it differently, but that would be something that like you would be more likely to see in borderline than bipolar, so they would probably ask those questions. Would be my guess. So anyways, there's ways around it. Obviously it's always complicated, but they could do a better job for sure.
So you told me at the beginning that I wasn't supposed to talk so long, but now I'm making you do all the talking, so.
Well, it's not the quantity of who's talking. It's the fact that I need to edit this in the next fucking 24 hours. That's the part that's difficult. So then we talk about the adoption and incidence of BPD. Oh, sorry, adoption and the incidence of BPD. This is a bit of a weird tangent, I felt like. It's interesting, but I'm not going to go through too much detail because I feel like it's not super like relevant.
No, I think we're back to this issue where I mean, I've not been adopted. I have friends who have, but I haven't talked to them in great detail about their experiences.
Yeah.
So I don't actually know, but maybe you have, I don't know. But it seems to be a very weird parenthetical thing to throw in here because, okay, so they talk about separation and loss and identity issues and inherited temperaments and mismatches in temperament and stuff like that. It's like, I would think that would be a possibility in any adoption situation for a kid that's old enough to know what's going on.
Yeah. So it says 20% of parents in NUTS, which is that support group, adopted their children. I mean, again, like that's definitely not a like scientific way of determining whether or not adoption makes people borderline, because people who adopt might have more access to services and more ability to find services due to like higher education or more money or that kind of thing that other parents might not have. So that might make the percentage of adoption higher. And then also things like if it's your own kid, you've talked about this before, you feel like, oh shit, this isn't a problem because this is just who I am. So that's just who they are. Or like, oh crap, I screwed up my kid and therefore I don't want to access services. Anyways, so long story short, this is just like a stupid way of saying adoption.
One other thing. I can totally see how an adopted kid would have issues with these things.
100%.
And yet not be borderline, but just be a normal, not very positive reaction to being adopted.
Totally.
I mean, so I guess the question I ask is, we're back to what causes borderline, right? We talked about this a little bit in the last chapter. Like, is borderline caused by the abandonment, or was borderline already there and the abandonment is just one more thing that reinforces what you feel already, or And I don't know if there's no cut and dried answer to that. No. Although I think these guys would like to say there is, but.
Yes, I agree that they would like to say that there is. It's interesting though, at some point in this chapter, they actually do acknowledge that there is a genetic component. So I thought that was interesting because they're kind of all about like, it's not your fault. And not that genetics are your fault necessarily, but if you read between the lines, I'm surprised that they put that in this book, you know? Anyways, that's the adoption thing. You can read it if you want. Honestly, I'm sure there's much more interesting papers about adoption and BPD than this book, because this book kind of sucks. Part of me wants to go through and read the Amazon reviews and as an episode. It had like 4.6 stars on Amazon.
Oh.
So if you want to do that after this, we can do that.
Okay. Yeah, I'd have to read the whole book before I read the Amazon reviews just to see if they were right. But
do you want to read the whole book? I feel like I have no interest in reading the whole book.
I don't want to read the whole
book. Yeah.
I'll help you with another chapter if there is one you want to talk about.
Yeah.
I don't want to read the whole
book. Yeah. I've read enough of the book to know that I can comment on Amazon reviews without needing to read the whole book. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. So then it gives another example of the parent who was the creator of nuts. And then it says one nut's parent was threatened by his son and put a lock on his bedroom door and slept with his clothes on and a key, car keys under the pillows. Again, like, sure, I know that my family at times felt like they were going to be murdered by me every night. I don't think that was ever actually going to happen.
I never felt that way. So
yeah. Well, dad never felt that way. Other people may have.
Yeah. I know other people did, but I never did.
Yeah. And that doesn't necessarily need to be examples that they're just going to continuously throw out here about how you're going to be killed by your kid. Because that's now the second or third example in this one chapter.
Well, and we're also back to using examples like kids putting locks on their doors and things like that. I mean,
this is the parent putting locks on their
door. Oh, I'm sorry. I read that backward. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's the parent
locking. You can edit that out.
It's okay.
It's
the parent locking his kid out of his room and then sleeping with his clothes and car keys under the pillow, blah, 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 blah. Like, anyways.
At what point, if you're that afraid of your kid, you got to wonder what kind of help they've gotten other than locking their own doors. Eventually your mother threw you out.
One of my parents threw me out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You can say that again.
except I'm going to make it worse by saying I told her to do that for years.
No, and exactly.
So
yeah,
I don't know how to edit that out.
No, that's fine. It doesn't matter. I think I've kind of given up on trying to do that now.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is this next sentence in this paragraph is, I tell parents that if they cannot control the abuse, they should call the authorities. You have the right to say no to abuse, even if it's from your own child. 100,000%.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I've said that on this podcast from day one. You need to take care of yourself before you take care of others, because if you can't take care of yourself, you're never going to be able to take care of others. And again, just because somebody's related to you does not mean that you owe them anything. That's an exaggeration. Parents should take care of their kids, but at the end of the day, you're your own person and they're their own person. And you should probably not have brought them into this world anyways, but that's a conversation that you can hear at the end of the last episode where dad and I debated having children for a very long time. You don't have to take it just because it's your family member.
Which is again, a little oversimplified, because you're as a parent, you're torn between, this is my kid and I love them. I care for them. I don't know what to do with them. I'm lost, mm-hmm. right? The system, as you've talked about many, many times in this podcast, is not helpful at all. So there's not a lot of support there. You don't want to go to all your friends and say, I need your help because my kid's nuts and I can't come up with something, right?
No, they're nuts. They're nuts, parent.
So there's that.
I do hope that that's changing though. I would hope that if you were parenting in 2023, that you would have much more comfort talking to your friends about what was going on.
Oh, I think you would in 2023.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you were born in 95 or something. So,
90, 93, but we can
pretend. Okay, fair enough.
We can pretend it's 95. My dad clearly does not have the unconditional love of remembering my birth year.
I just have a bad memory. I have it written in my wallet.
Because he's very old. That's why he has a bad memory. He's losing it left, right,
center. So I think that it's not as simple as just call the cops or just throw them out, because where are they going to go?
No, totally.
And
I didn't, like, I had to sleep at my friend's house because I didn't have anywhere to go until you took me back in.
Yeah.
Because I'd been kicked out of your house too.
Well, I know that's not true. You left my house. But
that's true.
But what I wasn't going to give you the automatic safe haven, like, oh, mom doesn't like me, I don't like mom, I'm going to go and live with dad. That's not right either, right?
No.
At some point, you have to take responsibility for why you're in the position you're in. And I think the only way to do that is to kind of make it difficult in that sense. And I think, I don't know, bad parenting or not, I don't know, but I did, that's what I did. So
luckily I turned out literally perfect. So as this book would make us believe, that's science. Because clearly that makes it fact. Why are you laughing?
Because if you actually came out perfect, this book would be completely wrong, as opposed to just mostly wrong.
Yeah. Fair enough. Anyways, it goes into how parents feel. It talks more about, like, that unconditional love is always there. I don't believe that for a second, but that's okay. And then it says destructive acts may cause you to actually feel hate towards your child. In between the love and hate come fear, confusion, resentment, wonder, happiness, and guilt. What do you feel about that?
I just didn't agree with this at all. I mean, my note here that I wrote in here is I never read about these things.
Okay.
But I don't know. I didn't really worry about your future.
Mm.
Neither
did I, because I figured I'd be dead.
Well, okay. Yeah. All right. That being said, I didn't worry about it because I figured you'd get through it. You'd work your way through it.
Right.
Or we'd work our way through it, or however you wanted to put that.
Mm-hmm.
All of the above is how you should put that. And so I never actually worried that much about it. But I also think that I didn't know a lot about what you were experiencing when you weren't at my house.
Mm, right.
As well.
Yeah. Fair.
So maybe I was just put blinders on. I didn't have to deal with it. Maybe.
Yeah,
I think that would be bad parenting, in my opinion.
And I think that happened on both sides. There's blinders, but different kinds of blinders.
Yeah, I think the blinders we're talking about are radically different blinders.
Yeah, but they're both blinders, and they're both not helpful.
Yes, I would have to unfortunately agree with that.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about sharing with your spouse? It talks about having a BPD child can destroy your marriage. And then the next sentence, it can also make it stronger. Blah, 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 blah.
I mean, sharing with your spouse is, like, if you don't, you're screwed anyway. So
yeah.
Whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. I find it weird. And it's throughout these two chapters that they don't even seem to give people credit for having normal relationships with each other.
No.
They don't act like the kid can. They don't act like the parent with BPD can, or the parent without BPD can actually have some of the same problems, like we talked about
in last chapter
9 over and over. It seems they've taken basically all the one-sided examples and went with it. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, in my first marriage, sharing with my spouse or the other way around was not as prevalent as my current relationship, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had to learn stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you have to do, and this is what they should be talking about.
It should be like the how, not the fact that, like, this can destroy your marriage. Like, how can you help it not destroy your marriage other than talk to each other, which is fine, but it doesn't actually even really say that. Just that it's important to share your feelings. And then it talks about how destroyed you can get because of this child in your life. Like, it's just not helpful.
And I think that we all know families that have broken up over the death of a child, over the stillborn children, over, you know, children who've gone off and done drugs. And I mean, these kinds of highly emotional things that happen between people in relationships can be devastating to those relationships unless you talk about it, unless you try to get through it, unless you get help and all these things. And they don't seem to give credit to any of that in here.
No.
Which I find really weird, because you'd think that that would be the whole point.
Yeah.
Of the book.
You'd think this book, it may as well just be called like bitching about people with borderline instead of like anything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then it talks about money and family concerns. And this is where it says every trip to a therapist or psychiatrist is well over $50. And I said, LMFAO, inflation hit hard. that's really my only feedback there. That, but I was like, God damn, that's rough.
Well, I'm going to give a little more feedback here, in the second paragraph there, it says, it would be nice if extended families were always supportive, but mental disorders are not well understood or accepted. And sometimes people deny that someone in their family could have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about that every time on this podcast. So that's enough said.
Totally. And again, I hope that that's different now.
I think that there's more conversation about mental health issues. Mm-hmm. The society in general is going more that direction. But I still think, as it says in the next paragraph, everyone figures that the parents are to blame. And I think that is absolutely true.
That they are to blame?
That people think that.
Oh, okay.
I think that like I've said many, many times, ad nauseum probably is, parents go into it not really knowing what they're doing. And it's very difficult because you're dealing with all kinds of different people, personalities, and issues. And our society is still quick to blame parents for when children go wrong.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is their fault, to be fair.
Yeah. Not even their fault, but they contributed to this. Right.
Yes.
So I think that's where it says, like, you know, there's a biological basis for BPD, blah, blah, blah. Like, I think that that's important, because the biology isn't your fault. It comes from the other person, but it's not their fault. Right. Anyways. And then it says, if your child could easily change and put a halt to his or her own suffering, he or she would do so, which is totally true. So I appreciate that. It says, we may teach our children that they cannot survive without us. Or sorry, if we step in too much, we may teach our children that they cannot survive without us.
The helicopter parent.
Yeah. We must walk a fine line between letting our children learn from their mistakes and protecting them when the disorder limits their capabilities, which Dad just talked about.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah. And it's not always right, easy to know what to do, but I think that it needs to be tried and to see what works.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit about that in the last chapter too.
Yeah. Okay. So effects on siblings.
So just so you guys all know that we're sitting in the same room this time. So when I do a heavy intake of air, Lori can actually see me.
That's true.
Normally we're not in the same house. So anyway, yeah. Okay. Sorry. This is a tough one.
It is.
Yeah.
This is probably the most difficult one for our family, I would say.
Yeah. I think that this is, yeah. And unfortunate we can't really talk about it in the detail that we would like.
Exactly. And that's fine. So
let's suffice it to say that there's an effect on siblings.
100%. And we've seen that.
And we've seen that. And there's also an effect on siblings from normal children. So-called. Sorry, that was not the right way. If I could back up, I would back up. So let me put it this way. I have a very close friend of mine, best friend, known him since I was born, literally. And, you know, he had an older brother who spent 16 years in federal penitentiary for molestation.
Mm.
He's had another brother who committed suicide.
Died by suicide.
His sister has, you know, like four husbands. You know, it's like all these things are hard on siblings.
Yeah.
And my friend was always treated like he was some sort of pariah in his family. So dysfunction can happen in any family, and hurting siblings can happen in any family. I think that there's a risk, and your comment on this would be great, there's a risk that the non-BPD child can be felt sorry for, because the sibling is unpredictable,
scary.
Maybe abusive, maybe scary. And I don't think that's a good response either. And I also think that the BPD child can be blamed for all the world's problems as well. And that's not the right response either. So
yeah.
It's not as simple as non-BPD siblings are hard done by or anything like that. It, the way these guys talk is everything about, you know, keep the BPD kid away from their siblings and stuff like that. And I think that's not the right response either.
No,
I, you know, I don't know if you've taken this, that from this book.
I mean,
that's certainly kind of what they seem to run away is their response.
It's true. That is their response to most things. I agree with most of that. I think there's definitely, it's easier to just blame the person with BPD as the scapegoat for the world's problems because their problems are more loud, basically.
Yeah.
And it's also super important that kids are kept safe, and same with parents, right? So this is where we talked about, like, sometimes you just have to call the authorities because there's no other option to keep people safe. I think all of that is true. I'm sure that the other kid feels like they're completely at a loss as to what's going on. And it's probably incredibly frustrating. And I think in a lot of ways, I don't know if this was exactly my experience, but maybe it was the experience of a sibling around feeling like the person with borderline is getting 100% of the attention. I really didn't feel like that was the case in my circumstance, but I can see where that would be the case elsewhere. Right.
But I also think that that can go the other way. Like I was saying, the sympathy card, the you're the world's problem card. I mean, either one of those things could be flipped around and you could get all the attention to the BPD kid, or you could give all the attention to the one, quote, suffering from the BPD kid. Let's put it that, as this book would put it. Right.
I've heard that directly.
Yes, I can imagine. So I think that what we could talk about, and this book never talks about, is there's a role for family, parents, even maybe siblings, to teach each other how to deal with each other. Mm-hmm. Like, what one of the problems with our situation is that when you weren't at my house, I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
And by the time I heard, it was usually weeks later.
And heard by one source that means not.
Yes.
Good.
And like, you need to fix this kind of things. And it's like, well, I mean, yeah, if you would have that day, I might have been able to do something, but 3 weeks, like 3 weeks later, doesn't gonna work. But I also couldn't teach your sibling how to deal with it either. And I'm kind of talking like I knew all the answers and I didn't, but in terms of teaching your sibling to stand up to you when she needed to would have been helpful. And she wasn't going to learn that from somebody who wouldn't stand up to you.
Yeah.
And I, you know, you and I, as we've talked many times, we would get nose to nose. And because that's kind of the way I am. So, and I think that would have helped each side. You would have had, I think, a better understanding of the effect you had on her. And she would have had a better understanding of how to kind of resist when you were dysregulated, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I think I want to this is not using good active listening at all, but I want to go back to something that you said right before that little bit about, like, you know, everything can go to, like, either all the attention can go to the BPD kid or all the attention can go to the non-BPD kid as, like, the sufferer. And I think in our example, like, the prime example of this was that our family couldn't afford for me to go to dialectical behavior therapy that was paid out of pocket, but my other family members went to get treatment at that same facility because they could afford to help them as the sufferers of my abusive behavior, but not help me with the fact that I was actually the root cause of the family's dysfunction in that circumstance, right? So, like, you'd think that, like, the resources could be put towards the person who is the one who's suffering with the abusive behavior that's then impacting everybody else. But instead, I was left with very little, if any, services. And the others were provided with this, like, really high class DBT service that I didn't have access to.
So I want to throw two things in there. One is, if in fact this book was the source of understanding, that's just a food for thought to throw in. And the other one is, if in fact people were told that you were unfixable because you had borderline, then you could see how coping with you was more important than fixing you or something. Fixing, I hate that word because that's not what it's about. But
no, it's a good point, though.
And I think that it just needs to be put in that pile of stuff.
Like, still sucks, but...
I think at this point, horrid.
Yeah, but you're right. Both of those factors would have played in. And like, resources are limited. Not where I would put my resource allocation, or allocate my resources rather, but not my resources. So
yeah,
it's unfortunate. What?
I'm sorry. That is so fucking understated. It's just crazy.
It's unfortunate.
Yes. Okay. All right. All right.
I've had like 20 years to process this. You want to hear another depressing story?
Okay. Go ahead. I'm all ready.
So the next section says, Kim from a non-borderline, this is the sibling. I have a lot of guilt about my sister. At times I wished her next suicide attempt would be successful. I have very few like vivid memories of things, but one of them is after I had been kicked out of my house, I had to go back to the house after like a certain period of time to pick something up or whatever. And have you heard this story?
Not yet.
And I happened to look on the mantle at the house and saw a card from my sibling that was like a Mother's Day card that had like flowers and butterflies on it or whatever that said, I'm so happy to see how happy you are now that Lori's gone.
Yes, I remember that story.
And like, as a chronically suicidal individual who was at like my lowest point, that's all you can think about.
I can't comment on it yet.
Yeah. But
I remember that story and it still makes me mad.
Yeah.
and I think part of I'm not as mad at the person who wrote it as the man and
the person who put it on their man.
Received it and put it on their man.
Yeah, agreed. And at the time I was very mad at both.
Yeah, now, well, understandably.
Now I'm less mad at the person who wrote it, although very sad and upset by the person who wrote it.
Yeah.
But also I can guarantee you that I've felt this way about people before too. It's like, sometimes it just feels like it would be easier. And that super fucking sucks.
Yeah. I don't know, like, what am I supposed to say to that?
But I also wouldn't write it on a card with like hand-drawn butterflies on it. But there's that.
No, that's good.
Mostly because I can't draw, but anyways.
Although you did tell your friends to kill me, so maybe I don't know.
I did not tell them that.
So I can't even, I've never actually been able to fully process that card. I'd forgotten about it. But I remember the story. I don't remember where when you even told me, because you must have been living at my place.
I was
at that point. Yeah. And one of the many conversations we had. Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what to. Still makes me sad and mad and all those other things.
Me too. There's also this bit about how she would feel obligated to make her sister her bridesmaid, even though she doesn't want her to be one. And I think that's super funny because I remember my mom, when I got engaged, she was like, oh, is your sister going to be your maid of honor? And I was like, what the fuck? Like, absolutely, like, of course not. If I asked my sister to be my maid of honor, she would be like, are you okay? And my mom was just like, oh my God, yeah, I guess like it just never occurred to me that like she wouldn't be. And I was like, okay, cool. It's really funny. I don't even know if I ever told my sister that, but she would also think that's very funny. It is what it is. That's the end of that siblings bit.
Next one.
The role of, let's go to a less depressing one. The role of non-borderline parents. Members of NUTS have found that they can divide their responsibilities into four major tasks. One, keeping the family member safe. Two, taking care of themselves. Three, taking charge of their child's medical care. Four, providing structured, consistent, and a loving environment.
So here they actually mentioned taking care of yourselves, which we talked about before, mm-hmm. Right? Where the guy, the person supposedly locked themselves into their room so their kid couldn't get to them and that. Yeah. So here they actually mentioned that taking care of yourself is an important thing.
Mm-hmm. So that's good. Yeah. Bare minimum. We're at the end of the chapter, mind you. But, you know. And then it talks, you know, the classic example of put your oxygen mask on before you put your oxygen mask on others. Yep. Like, agree. And then it talks about thinking about yourself as a whole person, not just your child's parent. It's common for one parent, often the mother, to take on the lion's share of the burden of caring for the child with borderline, but we urge you to share the work more or less equally with the other parent so that one doesn't become burnt out or resentful. That's just like a stupid patriarchy statement about how the mother is always responsible for taking care of the child, where I don't think that that's actually like, well, in our family, it definitely wasn't the case.
But, well, it's less so now. I mean, it's becoming less and less likely that the mother is having the full burden.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm sure it still happens because.
Totally. But mind you that like this book is old and that's an outdated.
And our situation was the other way around.
Maybe that's why I messed up.
Well, I wouldn't say the other way around. That's overstated.
Well, you were a stay-at-home dad.
I was a stay-at-home dad for like 10 years. So.
Which explains everything. No, we had a great time.
I'm not sure what it explained, but.
Then it talks about looking for people who you can can validate and count on to validate your feelings. They don't need to solve your problems. They just need to listen with a sympathetic ear. So that's important, obviously. And I think that's going to be more common nowadays than it was back then. Then it talks about taking charge of your child's medical care. We've had some good episodes about this before, about parents who have been really like positively involved in their kids' care and like being that advocating voice.
What I wanted to say here is I was on the child's medical care taking charge of it. I was one of those parents who essentially thought you'd get over it. Mm-hmm. Like we'd get you through this because we would just, you know, if I had to be nose to nose with you every fucking day, I'd be doing that.
Yeah, not really believe in mental health issues.
I mean, I won't say that I didn't believe they didn't exist. I was saying that I thought we would get through it.
Mm-hmm.
and without drugs, without, I mean, I think counseling probably wouldn't have been unreasonable.
Yeah. Cause you went to counseling.
I went to counseling for marriage, but I learned a lot about myself more than marriage.
Yeah. Cause clearly that didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. But in terms of, and I'm not a, there's a drug for every problem person,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
either, as you know. Because I mean, you knew my attitude before.
Mom used to hide antidepressants in my pads when I was switching between houses because we were worried that you were going to like freak out on us if we knew you were taking the medication.
And I don't think I would have freaked out.
But we were like legitimately worried about it.
I would have never been happy about it, yeah, for sure.
So we just lied for like years.
I want to, this is where I'm going with this is, so essentially, Lori, and obviously help from your mother, mm-hmm. to some extent, took charge of your mental health,
mm-hmm.
situation.
Yeah, Mom did advocate for me as hard as she could, I think.
Yeah, and I have to this day a letter that Lori wrote me that explained. Sorry, it's gonna be hard to get through. That explained your arguments with doctors, your reasoning for needing to take drugs for your conditions, for your lack of sleep and the fact you couldn't concentrate and those kinds of things. And you explained it in a very, very clear way. And I went, okay, she's thought this out.
Hmm.
She's actually looked through this and you took charge of your own mental health and chemical situation,
mm-hmm.
in relation to that mental health situation. And I know for a fact that you've argued with doctors. I know for a fact you've changed drugs because they were bad for you, but mm-hmm. you had to argue with your doctors about it,
yeah,
and all that stuff. And I want to say all that out loud because I think that this is, they may not say it here. I don't remember how they put it, but that is what you did. So I just wanted to say out loud, one, that I was resistant, like I talked about when the first podcast we mm-hmm. did, I said how parents are like that. And I was just speaking myself, even though I probably didn't say that in a mirror at the time. And Lori did hard work to get to fight doctors, to figure out what to do, what not to do, and those kinds of things.
And so, still do, unfortunately.
Yeah. I guess it never stops, really. Till the society decides that you're okay.
I don't know. I mean, my doctor actually just left. I had a nurse practitioner have a letter saying that she's leaving. And I'm like, fuck.
Does she know somebody?
I get automatically referred to somebody else in that clinic. But when I've been at that clinic, when she was on like vacation at one point and I needed a refill for something, and I had to get in a fight with the doctor because they were like, you can't take this. And I was like, I've been on it for 12 years. And they're like, well, you shouldn't take it. I'm not going to refill it for you. I was like, you're going to not refill my psych med I've been on for 12 years because you're just covering for like a day while my doctor's sick. Like, are you fucking kidding me? So I'm hoping that it's not that person. I have to call and ask. I just haven't had the guts to do it yet. But I'm actually trying to get off of that medication that he told me not to be on, and it's going really well. So hopefully it won't be a problem, but I just don't want to have to argue it with somebody every day I go to the doctor.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, you've got somebody, I mean, in a borderline circumstance, like you've got somebody who can easily get dysregulated,
mm-hmm.
having to argue with their doctor, not a good combination.
Well, but this is also like, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So like you go to a hospital and they treat you like shit. So then you react like a normal person would react if they've wanted to kill themselves. And then you're being told you have to try harder or you didn't try hard enough or blah, 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 blah. So then you freak out. And then the doctor goes, yeah, fuck people with borderline. And then the next time you come in, they go, fuck people with borderline. And then you get kicked out again. So then you react. Like it just goes on and on and on and on and on forever. Right. So it's like, God. I mean, and we see this with racism in healthcare where people just won't go to the hospital because they're like, I know I'm having a heart attack, but I do not want to go there and be accused of being drunk or high. So they don't go. And then
they die or
they die
disabilities
or then yeah, permanent disabilities. Or then like years later, something comes back up that like should have been an easy fix 20 years ago, but they were too validly afraid to go to the hospital. And like, we see it all the fucking time. And it's horrible. Anyways, that letter I don't remember writing, but if you have a copy of it and would share it with me.
Yeah, I have a copy. If you remind, just shoot me a text so I remember, but
I have a copy. I really like letter writing for big things like.
Oh, no, I bawled, which of course is not that surprising.
You almost did right now.
Yes. Yes. I do that.
You're allowed to.
Can I click and not be on the
screen here? No, I can hear everything.
Okay, well, it's okay. I'll stop.
But I mean,
remind me, I'll get it to send it to you. You can delete all this stuff anyway. Well, that part,
delete the whole thing.
Yeah.
Fuck this recording.
Delete the old man.
Yeah. It's just like back in Facebook days. Yeah. I mean, and like, you know, credit to my mom for doing her best to navigate a system she knew nothing about. Right. It's a lot easier to navigate the system if you work in it. And she was far from working in it. And luckily I had an aunt who was a psych nurse who understood this kind of thing. So we would rely on her a lot. People do what they can. They say, consider yourself the CEO of your child's care, directing professionals, managing the budget, making decisions based on what's best for all concerned. And I thought that was kind of an interesting way of describing it. And I have no issue with how they described it. My only issue is that like, they don't really talk about the kid making decisions for their own care. It depends on how old they are. Obviously, if they're like 3, you're making decisions for them. But 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, like it doesn't do enough credit to talk about like making sure that you're asking the child what they're wanting, because that will help improve uptake of treatment and that kind of thing. But either way, I think it's a good thing. They also talk about keeping good records. This I have some issues with. Did you also have some issues with this?
I did. It's, well, I'll let you introduce it and then.
Yeah, I'll just read the first sentence. So it says, one important duty is keeping a record of your child's behaviors, moods, and encounters with the legal and mental health system. Jot down your child's medication, doses, clinical appointments, note your conversations with officials and other parties involved. And then it says, it could be vital if you ever need documentation for legal purposes or help in making a diagnosis. So help making a diagnosis for sure. But again, going back to like documentation for legal purposes, they're not talking about like making complaints against the healthcare system here. They're probably talking about like
child abuse
or getting your kid arrested or getting your kid forcefully confined for treatment. Like they're not talking about the legal purposes that I would be talking about if I said document, because as somebody who managed a complaints department for a health authority, document for sure. If you're in an emergency room or a hospital or with a doctor and you're treated badly, write that shit down 100%. Because that can help you in the future, help prevent that issue happening to somebody else. But that's not what they're talking about.
No, they're talking about prevention of being accused of child abuse is what they're talking about. And I'm not saying that that might not be a good idea in some circumstances. I didn't, in like your case, which is the one that I know, I never felt that way.
No.
That isn't to say that in a couple of our conflicts, you would say, I remember one specifically, that you said, well, I'm going to call the cops. I said, do you want me to dial for you? Just keep in mind that you're not going to ever see me again.
You did say that, which I don't agree with, because that was like a threat that you shouldn't have said. But yes, I mean, there's that.
So just to end that story, what you ended up doing was you stormed out of the house and you sat on the front porch for 20 minutes and then you came back and you were fine.
Yep.
So I'm not sure my solution was actually that bad for you.
Yeah.
So was it technically correct? No. But I think that was the same incident where you kicked me in the shins and I kicked you back. And then that's when you threatened to call the cops. And it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, so you know, was that a dysfunctional event? Okay, fair enough. Did it end up correctly? I don't know.
Yeah, it did de-escalate on its own, but I wouldn't. Physical abuse is never a good idea.
And I'm not actually providing that. I'm not saying it is.
Working with care providers, respect their respect their position and expertise, but don't assume they always know best. The final decision is always yours. And then I put, or the child. So that is really important to know, that like, just because they're a doctor doesn't mean they know everything.
Yeah, that's one of the things I got right in the book.
Yeah. And then the next bit too, they say, if a clinician mistakenly thinks that BPD is always the result of abuse, or if he or she implicitly or explicitly accuses you of mistreating your child despite a lack of evidence, consider switching professionals. I say this similar to people with BPD who are accessing counseling. And if they've had a bad, if you go to a counselor and they automatically give you like stigmatizing energy, just find somebody else. Sometimes they're just not a good fit. And if they're already going to come into it with judgment, then just leave. Talks about dealing with the system. Do your best to ensure that your child doesn't fall through the cracks. It may mean making phone calls and personal visits. It may mean telling the powers that be that you will not take no for an answer. When you advocate for your child, you may find you possess an inner strength you never know you had. Our episode 2 weeks ago, I think, maybe three, called Three Generations of BPD talks about this. One of the parent, the middle parent, was talking about how they didn't work in the system either. And then they basically became like the advocate for their kid. And now they do work in the system because they realized that they needed other people like them. So would recommend listening to that episode. Providing an appropriate environment. People require structure and consistency, the same way that roadways require traffic lights and stop signs. Without them, utter confusion reigns. A physical and emotional injuries are more likely to result. I thought that was kind of an interesting analogy that I've never heard before.
Yeah, I mean, structure and consistency is, I mean, this is, I think, what makes good kids,
actually,
and makes good parents, in fact, which then makes good kids. You grew up in two radically different structures and consistencies or lack of consistencies. So, which, as we talked about in chapter 9, is confusing. Mm-hmm. Do you think, I guess, what kind of structures would have helped that didn't or did? I guess.
Well, I mean, I've always been a routine person, and having routine and like things like school and extracurriculars was really important to like keep things going. And I think like that's part of the reason that I don't have as many issues with depression is because of that routine. Because when that routine fails, things get messier for me. But yeah, I do think it's important. And it is harder with divorce for sure. And then harder in things like summer and winter when you have time off school or whatever.
Right.
Consequences. So trying to help your children grasp what will happen if he or she does not meet his or her responsibilities. That's just like part of good boundary setting as well. And then same with the consistency piece around holding your kid accountable for his or her actions every time. It says all parents have to fight the urge to let things slide sometimes, but with a borderline child, inconsistent reinforcement of rules can be outright disastrous. Yes, but also I think there's a time and a place for like being a nice human also. Like you should be as consistent as possible, but realize that like sometimes it's not helpful to be like 100% by the book at all times.
Yeah, and that's a tough call for parents in general, just for any raising any kid. It's hard to sometimes know what to push and what not to.
Yeah, totally. And then just to finish off, it says borderline children need love and affection as much as other kids. The key to loving your child is to remember that their behavior is caused by borderline personality disorder. Love your child, hate the disorder. Which I feel like is fair. And that's it.
What about this Brandon not non-BP thing?
Oh, I just ignored it.
Oh, okay.
Well,
I commented on it.
Oh, go for it.
Sure, why? What did I say here? Oh, what I said here was this thing where it talks about basically, I think this, they talk about, well, diagnosing between typical adolescent acting out behavior and behavior that's indicative of BPD can be difficult. And then it talks about some diagnosis or something like that and what should be in it, I think is what they're talking about. Oh, the evaluation may include the following: description of the child's present problems and symptoms, information about health, illness, and treatment, parents and family health and psychiatric histories, information about the child's development, school performance, friends, family relationships, if needed, laboratory studies and blood tests, etc. Did your first actual diagnosis have any of that in it? Do you remember?
Of borderline or other diagnosis?
Of borderline.
I had like a 10-minute appointment. But my counselor had been working with me for years and had already given the psychiatrist all of the information. So, I mean, but I also wasn't a child. I was 18. So this might be slightly different, but I mean, they will always ask you about your health and your health history, your family history.
This is all standard stuff in a
psych. It's all standard stuff. Yeah.
Right up. Okay.
Should be standard stuff in like any healthcare
interaction,
but yeah, no, it's all standard.
Okay. So then they go on in the next page 252, and this is where they talk about, I think they talk about grounding this kid as a punishment and all that, and that never works.
No, you guys weren't into that.
I wasn't into that because it never works. I guess I want to ask you what stopped you from doing the drugs and all that stuff. Like you did self-harm, I remember. Although I didn't know it at the time. And
ironically, it was fear of throwing up.
Yeah, okay.
Because I have like a really bad phobia about throwing up.
Oh, me too. I hate it.
Yeah. And
I'll do anything to not throw up.
Yeah. So drugs can make you throw up. Drugs, smoking can make you throw up. Drinking too much can make you throw up. So I just never did any of it.
So nothing at all to deal with nothing at all related to borderline or anything like that. It was.
No.
Yeah. You just never went there for other reasons completely.
Yeah. Just never interested me really.
Yeah.
Like even now I basically don't drink.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, cool.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it works out.
Yeah. No, that's great. Like
we actually had an episode about that the other day too, with somebody from Newfoundland. June 18th episode talks about the fear of throwing up and why it helps us not use substances. If anybody's interested in that episode. But yeah, it just never was an issue. Shopping, eating, self-harm, those were all my issues. I would absolutely have a gambling addiction, but I don't, because I just don't go. But every time I do, I'm like, fuck, I have a gambling addiction. And then Aaron's like, yeah. But I just like don't do it. So
do you believe in the addictive personality? That there are people who are just prone to be addicted to things?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think it, like in our circumstance, in our little world, it's like the impulsivity piece is more part, like why a lot of people use substances and like just self-medicating, I guess. But like, I mean, I can see people that like, you can see, you know, their parents had like severe substance use issues. And like, while they may not have substance use issues, you can see that they're addicted to a whole bunch of other stuff that you wouldn't
right.
necessarily like consider addiction, but it is, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I watched a friend's mother die of both alcoholism and cancer, and he ended up being a drug addict.
Yeah.
And it's like, what? Like, after seeing that, why would you do it? And I think
you just have no other option. Like, you just don't know how to cope otherwise,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, he's gotten over all that, but
yeah, we're pretty lucky in our family that that was never really an issue.
Yeah.
Like, it's just,
yeah,
like weird, but like, there's nobody that I'm aware of that has like a severe substance use problem.
My great aunt's generation had lots of it.
Mm, like one of the 20.
Oh, lots of the 20.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Several of them. But it was also the generation they were in, right? They were born in the 30s. They had money in the 40s after the war, and booze was cheap. The society, you could drink and drive. You could, everybody right. had a cocktail, you know. So it was just the society they lived in more than the one I lived in. And yours is even less, I think, than
yeah.
it was when I grew up. I drink more really? Often than I should.
Yeah.
And I think that it's more bad habit than addiction, but then again, it's hard to know the difference of the two. Right.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I know when we used to live with somebody that I won't name, but he would like every day after work, have a beer kind of thing. And he's like, I'm not addicted. It's just like what I like to do when I get home from work every day. And I was like, yeah, okay. Can you not do it though?
Yeah.
And it was like, I don't know. And so
yeah,
that it's just like kind of learning, but I mean, again, like not detriment to your life, then that's also like a component of it, right? Like there's,
yeah, I mean,
there's like, people that do heroin every single day and are totally functioning human beings.
Yeah, which is weird, but they do it.
Yeah,
you know. And there's alcoholics that are the same, like
yeah.
who just they drink all the time, like, every day and all the time, and they are fine. They yeah. appear to be fine.
Yeah, whether or not their organs are failing is another question.
Yeah, but that's another question altogether. But it's yeah, maybe. It's,
yeah, we've been lucky in that respect.
Yes. Sure. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to end it there because that was definitely not any shorter than it was supposed to be. But thanks for coming on, Dad. And we might have you back for another episode in the future.
Always a pleasure.
Hi, friends. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. Lori and I are so grateful that you're here with us on this journey, and we can't wait to dive into more topics in the future with you all about borderline, and even have some more fun and exciting guests to join us on the podcast. If you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. We would also love to see you interact with us on social media and on our Patreon page. The links to that are included in the show notes, so check us out there. We would be incredibly honored to get to know you all as you get to know us and our recovery stories. We love you, and we'll see you next time.